Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us here. Another Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest today is Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, always appreciative of people who take the time on a Sunday morning to come in and chat with us. So one thing, Mayor, not everyone is aware of, some certainly are, is that the mayor position is not the top city official with total government control. Can you talk about the pros and cons of being in a position where everyone looks at you as though you have everything to do with the good and bad things that are happening, but you don't actually wield the stick to make things turn?
Well, let me start by explaining a little bit about the Virginia structure. Virginia has, for virtually all of its cities and virtually all of its counties, a form of government that places either a county executive or a city manager as the administrative officer who runs the affairs of that jurisdiction. So we have a city manager. That's something the city manager system of government got started really in Stanton in about 1916 or so. It was thought to be a major step forward in progressive government because it basically meant that you had a professional, constant civil service sort of government, and then you elected the mayor, or you elected the member of the Board of Supervisors or City Council to set the broad priorities, but you relied on professional people to actually implement them. And that's the theory behind the city manager. So, for example, the interim city manager, whose appointment we recently announced, comes to us with a master's in public policy and 40 years in the field, actually almost 50 years when you look at when he started in this kind of work in 1972 when he got his MPP. He's a very highly trained, very experienced guy, and he's somebody that we intend to rely on and to rely on his expertise. It is expertise that no counselor is going to have. Now, we've all been involved in a lot of things recently. I've been involved in governance in Charlottesville for 40-some years, but I don't have anywhere near the experience of these people, and certainly not in the administrative side of things. So we will set the priorities. It'll be up to the city manager and the city staff, the pros, to do the work as we ask them to do it, but this is the way it works best, I think, particularly in a city of this size. The only city in Virginia that doesn't do it this way, really, is the city of Richmond. It has a strong mayor system. We have a weak mayor system. The strong mayor system has the mayor as the head of the executive branch, as well as involved with the legislative branch. We don't have that. I am purely a legislator. I am not an administrator.
Do you find any cons to that situation?
Well, the one con is that people seem to think, hey, he's the mayor, he's in charge, and I have to tell people, you know, I'm really not. I appreciate the confidence, but I'm really not. And I can persuade the others, I hope. I can persuade the city manager and the city manager. Ultimately, the power we have over the city manager is if we really don't like what he's doing and he's disobeying what we're telling him to do, we fire him and we hire somebody else. I can tell you that's not likely to happen, and it would have to be a pretty major problem before that kind of thing would occur. But that's ultimately the control that we've got. But that's if it's something doesn't rise to the level of that's a firing offense, he's in charge.
Charlottesville Mayor Lloyd Snook with us today. Mayor, you mentioned the recent hiring of the new interim city manager, Michael Rogers, I believe, proper name.
Right.
Right. Does that mean that are you still searching for a full-time, filled the position city manager?
Yes, we are. And that process will get back underway. I don't know when specifically, but it'll start coming in the next month or two. I would expect that we will begin the process. The issue, you know, when we were looking for an interim city manager, we told the interim city manager candidates we talked to that if they wanted to be considered for the permanent position, we would certainly be willing to consider them for the permanent position. But we're only actually hiring right now for the interim position, and so Michael Rogers will be with us probably 5 or 6 months, something like that. And then I hope that we will have a permanent decision made in time to have somebody here. Frankly, my shot is I'm trying to go for the 1st of July.
Can you talk about the challenges in doing the search for these positions, whether, I mean, the permanent and the interim?
In any situation like this, if you've ever been involved in hiring or making a major hire in a business or any other place, the challenge is to try to look at somebody and look behind their resume. They will, of course, always give you a very impressive-looking resume. You've got to have a certain amount of experience to be able to say, oh, okay, I know what he's really saying there. I know what she's really saying in that case. And then, you know, you go to Google and you look up everything you can look up about these folks. And in some cases, you find out, oh, they got fired from a job here. They moved on after just a very short time there. What happened? And sometimes when you start Googling, you start finding negative things, but you don't start finding the explanations until you go to about the 10th page of Google. You know, the first page is all of the scandal stuff. The 10th page is where the person gets exonerated. And so you've got to do that and keep looking for it and keep looking for it. We do fairly detailed searches of all of the databases that we can find. One of the advantages that we've had in this particular instance is that we are working through a consulting firm called the Robert Bob Group. And the Robert Bob Group has sort of pre-qualified their people for us. They have gone through and they've said, we know these folks. We have checked them out thoroughly. We are willing to present them to you as representatives of our business. And they've presented us with the information that they had on these folks as well. And so when we considered the credentials of Mr. Rogers, the two other candidates that we looked at, all of whom I thought were very impressive candidates, we were able to see both the good parts and the bad parts. And that kind of detailed background check, I think, is very important. And I think it's important to let folks know that we've done that in this case.
Michael Rogers is not the first interim city manager. And there have been many key personnel and replacements that have had turnover in the last 2-3 years. I'm going to read a list for the listeners. A city manager, there have been 6 in 5 years, including interims, multiple deputy city managers, the city attorney, fire chief of police, director of social services, director of human services, Director of Human Resources, Director of Public Works, of Communications, of Parks and Rec, an Information Technology Director, Housing Coordinator, Risk Manager, Office of Human Rights. I mean, I can keep going. How do you lose core people and continue to build strength with leadership and continuity under your council leadership?
Well, let me say, first of all, a number of the folks who have left were leaving for reasons that are completely understandable. Family problems, issues of, in some cases, the issue has been that we're not paying enough. A number of our people went to Albemarle County, for example, because Albemarle could pay them more money. We've had larger problems, actually. I mean, you've recited a number of the key leadership positions. We've also been having a lot of turmoil in places like the police department. Some of what has been going on is admittedly a reflection of chaos at the top. And but a lot of it is not. But let's talk about the news piece, and that's the chaos at the top. You know, we had Maurice Jones had been our city manager for 7 or 8 years. In 2018, his contract was not renewed. And so he's now in Chapel Hill, if I recall correctly, Chapel Hill or Durham, but has gone on to do well there. Then we had an interim city manager, Mike Murphy, who had been the assistant city manager, and he was elevated to the big chair, so to speak. And, after a while, and everybody knew at the time that was going to be a temporary thing while we went out to advertise for a full-time city manager. So Mike Murphy was always intended to be an interim. He was never intended to be a permanent hire. So we go out, we hire Teron Richardson. Teron Richardson arrives in May of 2019. He's on a contract that calls for reviewing his performance after a year. And so in May of 2020, council gets together, council looks at the whole situation, and we have a series of meetings, 36 hours of closed session meetings, where the topic of the performance of Dr. Richardson was on the agenda. That doesn't mean it's the only thing we talked about. I'm not going to say we spent 36 hours on Dr. Richardson, but it was pretty close to that. And finally, at the end of things, we decided we're going to stick with Dr. Richardson, and we're going to put him on a work plan that basically says, here are the top 10 things we want you to work on. And we had, I thought, an agreement between Dr. Richardson and counsel on what those 10 items were going to be. And things were going along fine until right at the tail end of August, for reasons I'm not going to get into at this point, Dr. Richardson decided he was resigning. And so he resigned, and then we had to figure out, okay, what do we do now? Well, we went to John Blair, who was the city attorney, and John Blair was willing to be the interim city manager while we began the process to look for another city manager. In the beginning of December, that all happened in September. The beginning of December, we had arranged for a consulting firm to do the recruiting for us, and consultant working with us, the recruiter working with us, a guy named Robert Berg. Robert Berg wanted to meet with all of the counselors. Mayor Walker said, I'm not going to meet with you. And to make a long story short, he concluded after that first week that council was too divided, was too dysfunctional, was not going to be able to make any decisions, and he recommended that we wait until after the next election. So then we said, okay, we're going to have to drop back and punt. And then we got the idea of, well, let's get Chip Boyles to come over from TJPDC, Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. Chip agreed. We brought him over. He began work in February, and everything there was fine until September, when on September 1st he fired Rochelle Brackney. The political hell to pay from that was more than he could deal with. And so in the middle of October, he left. He did not have a position as interim city manager. He was the city manager. But we also knew that we were likely to be advertising under circumstances where Chip would have been eligible to be one of those being considered. He basically was getting a road test for a year. And the distinction, by the way, I want to be clear about this, the distinction between acting city manager, interim city manager, full-time city manager, basically an acting city manager, come to think of it, that's actually what John Blair's position was. So acting city manager and interim city manager, there is tied up in there the notion that, you know, we're not really making permanent decisions here. We're just keeping the lights on and keeping everything going while we're waiting for the permanent guy to get hired. And so when we hired a permanent person in the form of Dr. Richardson, that's a very different level of responsibility from being an interim or being an acting. Anyway, so Chip, and also when we hired Chip, Chip had full authority, as any city manager would, and he exercised that authority when he fired Rochelle Brackney. So he then, in middle October, says, I can't deal with this anymore, I'm out of here. And he was gone by the end of October. He's now working at a planning district commission over in Fredericksburg. So then since that time, we have continued on with our deputy city managers, Sam Sanders and Ashley Marshall, both of whom are excellent. But they neither one of them has the position of the city manager. And so that's what we're looking to fill at this point. We can't go for long without a definite person in the city manager's spot, not only for the lines of authority, to be clear, but also we need somebody who is ultimately the authority on the budget. And that's one of the things that Michael Rogers brings to us, is a lot of experience in management and budgeting for cities. And so that's really great. Then we will finally be able to hire a full-time person, hopefully come July. So that's a long answer, but it's a really confusing situation, and we need to keep it clear.
Charlottesville Mayor Lloyd Snook with us today. Mayor, just a minute or two left before we take the first break. You used the phrase too dysfunctional, and I guess the consulting firm first time around suggested just wait until after the election. Has post-election removed the too dysfunctional part out of city council?
Well, it is, I think, made dramatic improvements. And just to be clear, you know, I don't want to be overly coy about this, but I don't also want to focus too much on the past. Our relationships with Mayor Walker were difficult. And she's a disruptor. She admits that. She wants to be. And she was disruptive, and that was intentional to a large extent. It just became very difficult for us to make a lot of decisions and to work collectively and collaboratively. That has changed since January 1.
All right. Again, our guest today is Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook. We're going to take our first break, and then we're going to come back. And we're going to talk about some other things besides just some of the staffing issues downtown. There are plenty of positives and other things going on that folks have questions and interest in. So hang tight, everyone. We'll be right back. And thanks, everybody, for being here with us again on another Sunday morning. Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook with us today. Mayor, if you Google... And you used the phrase Googling when you were in search for the background on potential candidates. If you Google Charlottesville, outside of getting the basic City of Charlottesville page, Charlottesville, August 11th and 12th of 2017, pops up near the top of every page. I'm curious as to what City Council, with you as the mayor, has interest in doing to return Charlottesville to the positive image that it had top 10 places to live, top 10 places to visit wineries, you know, et cetera. When you Googled Charlottesville pre August 11th, 12th, 2017.
Well, in fact, Charlottesville continues to win those sorts of awards and rankings and so on. The interesting thing is that Charlottesville's reputation in the rest of the world is actually much better than the way we are thinking of ourselves. What that means is that if you ask people in the around the country, around the state, they have basically all warm feelings about Charlottesville. They have, in some cases, warm memories of having been here and having been with us. Their opinion of Charlottesville is still quite high. When you ask people around here, we're all focused on either the events of August of 2017 or subsequent chaos or things going on in the city. We're seeing ourselves in a much different light from the way that the rest of the world is looking at us. The rest of the world, by the way, when they want to find out something about Charlottesville and they Google Charlottesville, the fact that August 2017 pops up is not really a deterrent. What we found is, and obviously we've had problems in the last couple of years with tourism and so on just because of COVID, but I'm confident that once we get past COVID, once we get to reopen the economy the way we want, once all of this begins to come together, that we will be seen by folks in the outside, on the outside, much the same way as we always were. That is not to say that the events of August of 2017 are not still with us. They are. I've likened it to a bell that continues to ring. But when a bell eventually dies out, the ringing eventually dies out, and we're left with the other ambient noises, the situation gets better. It gets better, and it's going to get better. And it's not going to get better just because I'm the mayor or anything. It's going to get better because Charlottesville is better than what we are willing to think of it ourselves. People outside have a much higher opinion of us than we do of ourselves.
August 2017 has now become sort of a one-word news timeline piece. It's a historical stamp or bookmark. Can we rephrase that, or do we just live with that so that we don't forget it?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to take the energy that we have had in response to August of 2017 and use that energy and use it right, use it well. Use it to say, okay, we have now had clearly identified to us these issues of racial equity and discrimination and history, and it's time for us to get it right. So when we talk about history, for example, I personally am glad that we have finally removed the statues. I came here when I was 8 years old from New Jersey, and I didn't know anything at all about the Civil War. But I found it very odd, even as an eight-year-old, that we had statues up to the folks who led the rebellion. That's just my Yankeeness showing up. I understand there are going to be people out there who talk about it in terms of their own heritage and so on. But that's always struck me as odd. And then to understand in a way that, since 2017, that I don't think anybody had really focused on is just – you know, we had these sort of Stephen Foster images of slavery and everybody was nice and happy on the plantation, and the reality finally, you know, was brought home to us in simple things like the movie, you know, 12 Years a Slave, where folks sat there and said, oh my God, that's what we're venerating. And since that time, we've been able, I think, to focus and refocus on what the real history of Charlottesville and Virginia and the South has been. And that's great. That's what we should be doing. Now, the challenge is, how do we construct a set of historical memorials, markers, trails, whatever, that emphasize both the amazing contributions to our nation from Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and James Monroe on the one hand, and also acknowledges that they were slave owners and what that meant, and that we get a full and rounded picture of these very complex people. That's a challenge, and that's not an easy challenge, and it's not something that, frankly, it's not something that a bunch of city councilors are going to solve. My hope is that we will have some very good historians and people who are well-rounded in the history of Charlottesville and of Virginia and of slavery and of the Declaration of Independence and all of the many facets of this complicated history, and help us figure out a way to present all of that to people who are truly, if anybody's truly interested in the full history. There's a very rich history to be told.
So, Mayor, again, our guest today, Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook, you just made mention that this particular issue is not a problem or not an issue that a bunch of city council members are going to solve. Understood. But can you tell me what one or two of the issues are that this bunch of city council members are planning to solve?
Sure. The probably the two major issues that we are focusing on and expect to be focusing on in the next few years. One is something we focused on a good deal this year, and that's affordable housing. That has permeated everything we've done for the last 2 years, really. And we finally have a comprehensive plan that acknowledges the need to get a real plan on affordable housing, to implement that that plan, to do something to increase the housing supply. You know, we have this real problem with inflation in our housing costs. And the reason is because we haven't been building enough housing as our population pressures continue. As long as the university keeps expanding, and it does, we're going to have more pressures of people wanting to come live in Charlottesville. That's completely aside from the things that we've been seeing more just in the last year or two of people who are saying, hey, in this mobile economy here where I can work from any place in the world, why do I want to work in some dingy suburb someplace? I want to go someplace nice. I'm going to go live in Charlottesville and telecommute. And we've seen a lot of people coming down to Charlottesville and Albemarle County telecommuting to other jobs. The jobs aren't located here, but they are now located here. And so we've got this other pressure on our housing stock. So we need to be building more housing, and we need to be doing it in a way that is environmentally sensitive, in a way that doesn't contribute excessively to traffic and all the rest. And so the challenge that I see is to figure out how we can make a transition from being a 20th century suburb kind of place, a town, to being a 21st century city. And that means that there's going to be higher density, and not every place, but many places. It means that we're going to have a better transit system. It means also, by the way, that, and the other thing that the transit system will bring us, I'm hoping, is a way to begin to get our greenhouse gas emissions under control. We passed a resolution a few years back declaring that we wanted to, we had some very ambitious goals on carbon neutrality and so on, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So far, the only progress we've made on reducing greenhouse gas emissions is that Dominion Power has switched to more solar and wind power and so on, and so their carbon footprint has been lowered, which means that we get to claim some credit for that. I think it's time we started doing some stuff on our own. I think it's time we started dealing with the transportation, the carbon emissions from driving. We know that in Virginia, something like 48% of the greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation, from driving. If we can get more people in Charlottesville able to take buses to work, able to walk to work, able to bike to work, if we can change the transportation culture of Charlottesville, we can begin to bring those greenhouse gas emissions down. So that's one of the things, the climate change piece, which I believe goes hand in hand with affordable housing. Because, I mean, let's face it, one of the biggest problems is if you've got folks who are driving 15 miles to come in to work in Charlottesville, they're releasing a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. The reason why they're living out 15 miles? Because they can't afford to live any closer. So we've got these problems that are intertwined, and we're going to start to work on those.
I think part of this topic is the future land use map, which we'll get into a little later in the hour. But if you're talking about people working remotely, if you're talking about people being able to bringing in more people to live and work in Charlottesville, aren't you talking about having better internet access, some sort of fiber internet? And if you are doing that, how is Charlottesville contributing to make it happen throughout the city and then spreading out into the county as well for these residents, whether they're already here or whether they're moving here?
Well, I don't think Charlottesville either has the ability to, there's one way in which we have the ability. There are some funding sources that can be tapped into, some state and federal money for improving internet access. I don't think that that's really that serious a problem in the city of Charlottesville. And certainly as we're switching to a fiber network, you know, Ting is spreading more and more throughout the city. There are going to be some little things that will come up from time to time. I've talked to some people who, for example, can't get Ting because of some issue with a particular phone pole or light pole or whatever. There may be some situations there where we perhaps end up having to kind of mediate some disputes. Although, for the most part, those kinds of issues are really fixed out of Richmond. Almost all utility kinds of questions have to go through the State Corporation Commission. So we're going to be limited in what we can do in that respect. To draw on something, I was writing an email to a constituent last night about, they're saying that we wanted to be undergrounding utilities. Well, you know, undergrounding the power in particular, the problem is that we don't have the authority to require that. And so we end up having to, if we were to go to Dominion Power and say we want to underground the utilities on this block, they could say, well, okay, the cost of that's going to be $500,000. Well, $500,000 is an awful lot of money for a city of our size, and we've got an awful lot of blocks. It would take forever to do it at that rate, and we just can't. The point is, that's something that's fixed in Richmond, and that's just something we don't have the authority to change. So the original question was about what we could do about internet access for people. I don't really see that as a Charlottesville problem, but as a government problem. But there are a few things. One of the things that has been done, for example, there's internet access, Wi-Fi on the downtown mall. There are things like that can be done that will help a little bit. We also have to be conscious of the fact that there are a lot of people in Charlottesville who don't have access to the internet at all, either because in some cases they're elderly and they just don't get all this newfangled stuff, in some cases because they're poor and they don't have the ability to buy the equipment. There are going to be some things we can do to help there, some equity issues. One example, people don't necessarily think about a library as an equity issue, but that is in fact how a number of people get access to the internet people who don't have access at their home or they don't have a reliable connection at home. They go to the Jefferson-Madison Regional Library, and they can get online there. Support for those kinds of efforts may be important. There may be some little things we can do. The major focus, though, is going to have to be elsewhere.
Well, I appreciate the answer, Mayor Snook, but I think currently the internet system is matching where our needs are now for the average person. But if you put Xfinity in a home, and then you put two or three people trying to use that, you are diminished by the speed and the quality, and then society is only picking up the usage and demand, and the providers are not matching that, which is why I asked the question about, can the city keep up and look ahead on providing this for incoming people who, as I believe you said, are coming here because they are remote and can work anywhere. And so that's why I was asking specifically about not current internet access, but making Charlottesville a better remote place with the quality of what is provided, which I think we are sort of in a standstill, not beating or bettering the average town.
Well, I understand your point. I guess I would say, first of all, that ultimately one of the solutions may be that more and more of our residents opt for Ting service. That's a fiber. I'm not trying to do a commercial for them. I don't have Ting at the moment. I've got Xfinity, but actually, I guess we have Ting at the office. But anyway, my point is simply that there's a market solution for that, and it is not something we have the financial ability to do very much about. There may be, as I said, there may be some sources of funds for a few things, but not very many.
Let's take our next break. We'll come back. Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook. We'll talk about a few other things. We'll get back into that future land use map, which has a role in affordable housing, and the mention about UVA growing. Also, some things there going on in the Ivy Corridor. Be right back. And thank you so much, folks, being here with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Mayor Snook, UVA Foundation recently purchased some property in the Ivy Corridor. I believe it's Ivy Square. Foods of All Nations is there. A lot of people may know it by that. Doesn't that end the tax income, the real estate property income for the city with that purchase?
Not necessarily. And there's a little distinction we have to draw here, that the university, back in about 1980, recognizing the force of the argument that says if the university buys the property, they take it off of the market, they take it off the tax rolls. The university has been buying this property in the name of the Real Estate Foundation. The Real Estate Foundation is not a tax-exempt entity. So as long as it's still owned by the Real Estate Foundation, then it can be subject to property taxes. The question that I don't know the answer to, to know about what the university intends with that land for the long term, but it is clear that the university has wanted to have the ability to control all of those crucial parcels in and around where they are now, and that the whole idea that they're building this new school of data science there, many, many, many millions of dollars for the structure. My guess is that if the property ends up as off as, let's say, classroom stuff, it's probably going to end up as being transferred from the Real Estate Foundation to the University of Virginia itself, and at that point we would not collect taxes. But I have to say, there was an agreement going back, it's about 1980, and I haven't looked at that agreement in a while, and I don't know whether whether it is still being followed the same way. Again, the theory was supposed to be that the university wasn't going to buy more of the city property, wasn't going to take more of it off the city tax rolls. It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I have hopes that they will leave it in the name of the Real Estate Foundation.
Are there specific pros and cons to working with UVA and Albemarle County, with Charlottesville being surrounded, and in UVA's case, in the center and growing outward?
Well, I think the answer is we have to. It's not a choice. We have to work with the university. We have to work with the county. And we need to get back to planning together. We've fallen away from that in the last few years. And I've met, just in the last month or so, I've met with President Ryan. I've met with Donna Price, the chair of the Board of Supervisors. We've talked about what we can do to work together and to plan together. Ultimately, we know, and they know, that we are all interrelated, that Albemarle County does not profit by having an impoverished city of Charlottesville. The University of Virginia knows that they will never attract quality faculty and quality students if the city and the county are not planned well, if there's no good housing for them, if the roads are so horrid. Just to use an example, at sort of the other end of the continent, Stanford has recognized for many years that they've got a real problem for affordable housing for their faculty. And so they have had to make a major program that they've used to basically help junior faculty buy housing out there. We're not to that point with the university on a full-time, you know, a real big basis, but that kind of thing has been known to happen, and it's a problem that we all deal with. So my message there is that everybody knows the university will profit by having a good city, a strong city, good and strong county, and having everybody working together. The challenge for us is the university is permitted by state law to do their own planning, and they don't have to tell anybody what they're up to, just like any other property owner. They don't have to tell anybody what they're up to. The difference is that they can do things that basically we're not allowed to regulate. For example, there's a case law out there, attorney general's opinions and so on, that say that we don't have the power to impose zoning requirements on some of the things that the university is doing. So there are going to be things that they will be doing on city property that we don't have the power to stop. On the other hand, we have the power to jawbone with them, to complain to them, to make sure that they understand just what exactly our problems are. We also have enough other relationships. For example, you know, they get their water, they get their fire service, they get an awful lot of police assistance. There are a lot of ways that we help each other out, and I don't want to be saying, you know, well, we would hold our fire department service back if they don't do this, that, or the other thing. But everybody understands we've got to make this work together. And as long as we're not approaching it as an adversarial relationship, we'll be fine.
Mayor, do you have any personal hobbies or interests that might have be bringing you lessons into your mayoral position?
There are a number of lessons I've learned from some of my hobbies. One that I refer to from time to time is I like to play bridge. And one of the things you learn in bridge is that if you're trying to make the hand, if you're trying to make the contract that you've bid, you're trying to make the hand, and there's only one way that things will work. You've got to assume that the king of spades is to your left, for example. That's the only way it's going to work. assume that and go for it. It's called the doctrine of restricted choice. There are a lot of decisions that we have to make where if every decision was a completely 50-50 thing and we would have no way of moving forward. But every now and then we have to say to ourselves, the only way that makes sense going forward is if X is true. Therefore, let's, number one, assume X is true, or number two, make sure that X is true and go that way. That might be one example. Another example, I like to play golf. The first thing you learn as a golfer is when you step up to the second shot, don't be thinking about the first shot. You know, you just got to move on. And, you know, so if you've just hit it into the rough, okay, the challenge is how to get it out of the rough. The challenge it is to not sit there and kick yourself and say, what kind of an idiot would hit the ball there? You just got to get the ball out of the rough. Keep moving.
All right, Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook with us today. So, Mayor, let's go back. You mentioned earlier about one of the things that you think this city council can do is improve affordable housing. And based on my readings, it seems that you can be doing that by approving the future land use map that was recently done. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Sure. The whole controversy in the comprehensive plan, and just so folks will understand, every city in Charlottesville, every city in Virginia is required to have a comprehensive plan. It is a plan that is supposed to say what you're hoping your government will do in transportation, in education, in making sure that you've got a water supply and a sewer system and everything else. But it's also probably the part of it that we argued the most about for months is a part called the Future Land Use Map. And what this is it says this is how we think the city of Charlottesville should be developed in the coming 5 years at least, because a comp plan is supposed to have a five-year horizon. But ultimately, the best comp plans don't look only 5 years in advance. They look 20 years in advance. And so, to me, the first thing that needed to be done, we needed to recognize that Charlottesville will continue to grow. Historically, Charlottesville in the last 50 years has grown at the rate of about 1% a year. Historically, the University of Virginia has grown at the rate of about 1% a year. No coincidence. The challenge right now, of course, is that the county has been growing at more than 1% a year. And one of the reasons that's been happening, frankly, is because we haven't been building enough housing in the city of Charlottesville. In the last decade, really the last major housing projects were the ones that were done, the large apartment buildings on West Main Street. And that was finished in about 2014. Since that time, we've been growing not at 1% a year, but about 0.2% a year, not because there's no demand, but because there's no supply. And so we need to do something about more supply. Here's the problem. Housing supply is very easy to provide when you've got a lot of blank fields, when you can just go plow up some ground and plunk down some houses. It's very difficult to do projects of any size through what's called infill, and that's what we're having to do now. We had in our very recent city council meeting a discussion of two projects on Park Street, for example, the old MACA property where Piedmont Housing Alliance and Habitat for Humanity are going to put close to 100 units of affordable housing. And then on the grounds of the Park Street Christian Church, a few blocks away, another 100 units. Those are infill projects. They're surrounded by places that are already built up, and you can't just sort of go in and level everything and say we're starting from scratch. So infill is difficult. Infill is expensive, and infill also means that we are stuck in some cases with antiquated road systems and other infrastructure issues that are a problem. Our challenge has to be, if we're going to be adding more capacity to our housing stock, our challenge has to be, where can we put it that we know it's going to inconvenience some people, but we have to figure out how to mitigate that inconvenience. We have to figure out how to make sure that it doesn't destroy the neighborhood that it's put next to, things like that. And that's a difficult decision, and it involves making some basic judgments that I think we've struggled with, but they're decisions that I personally think the decisions we've made recently have been the right decisions and good decisions. But I fully understand that the neighbors are going to look at us and say, you know, what were you thinking? I hope that the answer will be that 10 years from now, people will look back and say, that wasn't so bad after all. And sometimes that wasn't so bad after all is as good as it's going to get. So the issue for the future land use map, just to sort of fully answer your question, is that we need to designate spots where we're willing and think we are able to put significantly more units. At 1% a year, that's basically going to be, you know, 20. That would be basically about, 200, 1% a year, about 200 more units a year, year over year over year over year. That's not going to happen one at a time. That's not going to happen because Joe down the street puts in a duplex in his house, though some of that will happen, and that's good. But it's not the only way we're going to get there, and that's going to be a challenge, and there's some people who are going to be upset with us.
My homework showed me that there are three categories now. Previously, there was the general residential category and the high-density category, and now there will be three, the general residential, which was a maximum of three units, think triplex on all residential parcels. Now there will be a medium intensity residential, which is the new addition to the concept, which allows for 4 to 12 units per parcel, and the already existing high intensity residential, which allows for 13 units or more. And it said that previous reporting said that you were against adding the medium intensity as an option. Why is that? Is that accurate, and why?
Okay, first of all, let's understand that the future land use map is not a zoning map. It's not a zoning ordinance. The zoning ordinance has not changed. The zoning ordinance is going to get rewritten in the next 12 to 15 months. And this 1 to 3, 4 to 12, 13 and up set of distinctions is almost surely going to be changed. It's almost surely not going to come through the zoning rewrite in exactly that fashion. My reason for not want what I said was, I want there to be a medium intensity residential category, but I am not prepared to say right now that these particular parcels are the places we ought to be putting that medium intensity residential for a number of reasons. Number one, because we haven't done a lot-by-lot, block-by-block study of it. There are some places, for example, one example I've been using is on Evergreen Street, which is a small street off Park Street, which is narrow, which does not have room for parking on the street and for two cars to pass, where I'm recently a moving van trying to make around one turn got stuck because the road was too narrow. And so that just doesn't feel like a place that makes a lot of sense to be talking about more density. On the other hand, if the city were to say, if we're going to put more density back there, we have to be willing to say that we're willing to widen the street. Okay? That would seem to make some sense. But if we're going to be willing to widen the street, that means we've got to exercise the power of eminent domain to take property from the front yards of all of these houses. Is that
never popular? never popular.
And also expensive, because we've got to pay them the fair market value of that footage. So we need to think critically about what we're going to do there, and we didn't have the opportunity to think that critically. Now, the other piece of it, the reason I said let's not actually designate the spots right yet, is that everybody who now lives next to one of these medium intensity designated lots is sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, there's going to be a 12-unit apartment building in my backyard. Well, no, that's actually not going to happen. But we can't tell them that until after we've written the zoning ordinance. So let's write the zoning ordinance. We will see when we do so that we will, in fact, have to build in some limits on the capacity and so on. And what we're doing right now is we're just scaring people unnecessarily. And that was the reason I wanted to not designate the spots yet, but to do so after the zoning ordinance rewrite has completed, and to do so after we've been able to look at things more carefully lot by lot.
Last question, I think, as we're running out of time here today. Someone, I can't say it was used, quoted as the future land use map that's been determined is more opportunities for small businesses to open and operate. Can you talk about how that might happen in about 90 seconds I'll give you?
Sure. One of the categories in the future land use map is something called a mixed-use node. And the idea is that in certain areas, and you see this in virtually every major city of any significance, there will be probably a mile or two separation between little commercial areas, a pizza parlor or a 7-Eleven or something like that. And so in these nodes, these mixed-use nodes, you get a couple of parcels that are there with a couple of small businesses operating, and it's kind of integrated with the neighborhood. And you see that all over the place in larger cities, in particular in cities where they've made some of the changes that we're starting to make. At some level, to some extent, that could be just a really neat little feature. Not sure how it's going to work in the long run. Still got to work that out.
Again, our guest today, Charlottesville City Mayor Lloyd Snook. Mayor, thank you so much for being here and wishing you great success in your task
on
City Council.
We're going to need all the good wishes we can find.
All right. Take care, sir.
Thank you.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.